Accession number 27083, Reel 61.
So Henry, on the back of an envelope on a wet Sunday afternoon, John Lott...
He set out what he judged to be the fundamental parameters to meet the cuts exercise. So this started, and it came to be rather irreverently termed the Bermudagram. And underlying his thinking was that the Air Force was a bit thin, the Navy was a bit fat, and the Army was about right. And he proceeded accordingly. These were preconceived ideas. They were not brought about by any of the briefings that he had so far received. But he stuck to those principles throughout his time as Defense Secretary.
Where did the Bermudagram come from? Out of his head? Someone must have put it into his head, if it came from somewhere else.
I think he, well, in the course of briefings, of course, he picked up a certain amount of knowledge, even though he was entirely not au fait with the whole question of defence. But he was an intelligent man, and when briefed by this or that or the other person, he drew certain conclusions, and that was the result. That's what he concluded.
So would you say that this was briefings by the Air Force could possibly have resulted in? It certainly couldn't have come from the Navy.
It didn't come from the Navy, no. And indeed, I hadn't briefed him. Well, I've just told you how I briefed him. He asked me, why we needed surface ships, which wasn't very clever. No, I don't think it came individually from the Air Force either. I think that it was an amalgam. And I'll give you an example. The chief scientific advisor of that day was a man called Ron Mason, who, I think he was a chemist. He was a fellow of the Royal Society, and so he was well up in the scientific circle. But he just knew, he was absolutely convinced that the next war, certainly the next maritime war, would be fought in the Iceland-Faroes Gap, the Greenland Iceland-UK Gap, and that the vehicles engaged in that war would be nuclear submarines and maritime patrol aircraft, and the rest of it passed him lightly by. Well, that's a very specific scenario, and had you actually formulated your entire naval capability on that premise, you would have been in for big trouble, as events turned out, e.g. the Falklands, which could not have been undertaken. And I don't want to quote the Falklands as being a typical example, because it wasn't. It was atypical, but it was a perfectly pragmatic one, and there were other bits and pieces of interest about the world where you couldn't have achieved anything by such means. Anyway, that was a typical example. So John Knott came back to Whitehall with this general theme, and from there the defence policy staff, that is the central staff, were given various remits to examine, which ended up, of course, on the single service plates, to examine what savings should be made in respect of finding for each individual service, and it varied, and to an extent, the centre, to what they would have to do to find the money. and make proposals. And this was really getting down to, I won't use the phrase nitty-gritty, because these were big things, because it was big money. And the sort of things that went on, for example, John Knott was not very keen in going round and seeing things for himself. And he made very few visits to the Navy, hardly any to the Navy. And I don't say that particularly the Navy, because I don't think he did to the other services either. Dennis Healy was played very much the same game. He hardly ever visited any single service. He sat in Whitehall. He might visit their commanders. He came out to the Far East on one occasion before the setting up of Unified Command and so on. And it's a way of doing business, but it's it doesn't strengthen the rapport between the defense secretary of the day and the service of that same day, any of them. One of the things that he was fairly determined, and it was quite a big saving, was to sell Invincible to the Australians. Now, Invincible had more than proved herself in terms of capability, as I think I mentioned earlier.
There was an exercise with the Americans with the new Harriers.
That's right. And she'd shown up very favorably with them. So quite a bit was known about the Harriers and its capability, and still more about Invincible, which rarely had achieved beyond most people's wildest dreams. And John Knott was adamant that she should be sold at a pretty bargain basement offer to the Australians. And he stood by this, and nothing would deflect him. And the Australians, I well remember, the Australians sent a delegation over to discuss the details of this. And they had some junior minister, and it was headed by the Thirsty Lord Equivalent, who was actually a vice-admiral, who curiously was also called Leach, David Leach, very nice man, and I'd taken him as his instructor through his sub-lieutenant's gunnery course. And we were friends. And the meeting started with lunch, and then we all repaired to John Knott's room, and in a curious way, he turned to me and said, would I like to lead off? And I said all the good things about Invincible, and I said the plain fact is she's not for sale. She's an integral part of the RN fleet, and she's badly needed. She provides a capability which cannot be matched by anybody else, and she's not for sale. And you could have heard a pin drop, and the poor Australians didn't know what to do and where to look. And Knott was a bit floored by this too, because I hadn't minced my words. And he said, well, that's we'll see, sort of thing. And of course, ultimately, he could hold the whip hand on this. Whether the Australians knew that or not, I don't know. And I then had to prepare various devices to try to get round the equivalent savings without having sold Invincible. And this wasn't easy, because it meant something else, probably something in the plural. And I tried these out, and it didn't really get anywhere. And in the Chiefs of Staff Committee, there was a certain amount of dissent over this, Terry Lewin, sailor, chief of defense staff, tried to play it scrupulously fairly, so that in no way, because he happened to be a sailor himself, would he come down on the side of the First Sea Lord, even though he, in his heart of hearts, might well have wished to do so. Chief of the Air Staff was adamant that here at last was an opportunity to get rid, for all time, to get rid of those goddamn carriers, which constituted something of a rival to his service. And he was pretty vociferous and caustic about it, and quite ruthless about it.
Quite ruthless?
Ruthless. What's about saying, you know, this is absurd, and of course you must go, and that sort of thing.
Ah, ruthless in an above-the-line manner, not in a devious manner.
Oh, no, not in a devious manner at all.
Right.
And I was equally ruthless in the opposite direction.
Holding the line.
Yeah.
Did the chief of the general staff have anything to say, or was he keeping his head down?
No, he sat in the fence. And the time came when we really needed, because of the way the papers were progressing, and did they include the sale of Invincible or did they not? And there was I can't remember what the figure was. It was a figure of 56 million rings a faint bell, but I shouldn't really say that because my memory is rusty on the precise figure. It was a lot of money anyway. And I made a date to see John Knott one evening at 6 o'clock. It would have been a Thursday evening. And I made this 10 days ahead, this date, to see him and have out finally the question of whether Invincible was to be kept or not kept. And as far as I was concerned, it was kept. Because without this, it just made a monkey of all the workings of what else the Navy had to do and so forth. And I went along at just before six and was ushered in by his nice private secretary, who is now, he's the head of, I can't remember which department, David O'Mann. Very nice man and very able. And I was ushered into John Knott, who was on his feet and sort of stumping about his room in a rather agitated fashion. He was in a hurry. He said, I haven't got time to see you now. I've got a train to catch, and I've got to get down to my constituency, which was in Cornwall.
Sometimes.
Yep. And I said, Secretary of State, I made this appointment with you 10 days ago. It's a matter of the utmost seriousness. I can't sensibly proceed with the naval contribution to the cuts exercise without it. And we got to talk it through. No, he said. And he went on and on. And I got increasingly irritated. And he was starting to make for the door. And I said, Secretary of State, if you go, I can't stop you. But if you do, I shall follow you to Cornwall, and we shall have it out there. And I don't think that's what you would like. Oh, of course you would, he said. And he flung out of the room. And I was furious. And I went back to my room, and I simmered down, and half an hour later I summoned David O'Mahon and had him in and said, now look, I meant what I said. I don't know whether Secretary of State is going in Cornwall, but you do. It would be helpful to me, and it would save a lot of wasting a lot of people's time, if you could let me have precisely what his program is. And I will tell you what I'm going to do about meeting him, because I meant what I said. I am going to follow him to Cornwall. And he was staying, he was going to stay at Carhaix Castle, which was owned by the then chairman of the Cornish County Council, I think. And I found, in due course, David Emmon came back with the details. And I said, right, I will, I'll catch the, whatever it was, the 12 o'clock train from Paddington to take me down to, it went as far as, I'm forgetting all my names, anyway, it went into Cornwall, and then there was to be a car provided by RAF St. Morgan to pick me up and take me to Carhaix Castle. And I said, I think it would be very wise if you came too. And he looked a bit sideways at that, and I said, well, the reason is that I think there really ought to be, and who better than a civil servant like yourself, there ought to be something by way of an impartial witness for what is going to be a fairly important conversation. And eventually he agreed, and that was that. And we met next day, and off we went to Paddington. That night, the previous night before we embarked on the train, one of those freak things, this would have been in probably the first week in November, it snowed.
81,
yes.
It snowed, yes.
It snowed. And you know what happens when it snows before it's expected in this country. Everything comes to an immediate grounding.
Or even when it is expected.
Even when it is expected. And so it was. And the train didn't leave Paddington until 1 o'clock. And it drew into St. Austell, which was the closest we could get, late. But there was the RAF car. And we arrived at Carhaix Castle at, I forget whether it was 8 or 9 o'clock, I think it was probably 9 o'clock at night. And it was bitterly cold, bitterly. And John Knott, to his credit, wearing a nice thick country suit, he came out. And he met us in the by the front door. I think it was still snowing then, even in Cornwall. And he said, I really didn't think you meant it. And we went in, and now I'm forgetting my names again, but the charming host and hostess, the owners of Carhaix Castle, they had a son down from London in his early 20s or so, and we all had family supper in the kitchen. And it obviously wasn't Williams was the name, and we've kept in touch ever since as a result of this curious incident. It wasn't appropriate during supper to raise my points and have it out with John Knott in front of the others, whose business it was not, and so on. But they took their time, and they weren't quite ready, and all that sort of thing. And time was rolling on. And I wanted a clear hour with Knott before I had to leave, which was a half-hour run or so, to go back to St. Austell and catch the night train back. And so we finished our main course, and I suggested to Knott, looking sort of between him and my host, that Knott and I should go out into the drawing room or the study or somewhere on our own with David Ehrman and have it out. We could have our pud there on our laps. And this is what we did. And we went at it, hammer and tongs. And John Knott was not for giving anything away. And as I say, we argued and we argued and we argued. And David Ehrman was taking notes, but not intervening at all. And eventually, Julian Williams came in to say that he really thought we ought to go because it was snowing again. And we'd miss our train, if not. So we went. We packed it up. And John Knott came with me in the car down to St. Austell, about a half hour's run. And we were at it, hammer and tongs. And the air conditioning, or the heating, didn't have air conditioning. It was a very crummy old car. I forget what David Ehrman did. I think he came back too. And it was all go or all stop in terms of the heating. And if you had the heating on, you were warm, but you could hardly breathe. There was such a fug up. And if you cracked a window open, you froze to death. So we were conditioning ourselves physically and had done so by the time we reached St. Austell, where we had reached no conclusion at all. I meantime, because her capability was unique, I had offered to pay what the Australians were going to pay in order to retain Invincible.
Pay by way of saving?
No, so that I would effectively cough up the money that the Australians were going to cough up, and where I would find it from was my business, and that wasn't, I'd sort that out later. But such was the uniqueness of this ship's capability that I felt justified in doing it. I don't know where I'd have got the money from, but I'd have got it to come hell or high. He dismissed that and said that was absurd and that sort of thing. I said, well, it's not absurd at all. And all your, or all you should be really seriously interested in is getting the precise sum of money that you wish to extract from the Navy Department. And I'm telling you that you can do it that way, and I will see that you get it. Oh, no. We were still arguing when we arrived at St. Austell. And he came out on the platform, and the train was scarcely more or less to time, and it was freezing cold, so he pushed off back. He wouldn't give me an answer. He said he would inform the duty clerk, who was the sort of the duty civil servant, the resident clerk, I think he called himself, in the MOD in the morning, which was a Saturday morning. And I went back. I knew then what the answer would be. And the answer would be no. And I went back and come later that morning, and I won't bore you with the fact that the heating had failed in the train and so on. So it wasn't a very happy night by any means.
It's 6 hours from St. Austell to Paddington.
The what?
It's 6 hours.
6 hours, yes.
In the cold.
In the cold. And we arrived more or less on time, I suppose, and I contacted the resident clerk and the answer was no. So that was that incident.
May I stop you there just for a second?
Yes.
I'd like to back, well, I've got three questions here for you. I'd like to backtrack slightly. Can you, first of all, because people listening to this may not know the characters of the other principal participants in the drama, could you give thumbnail portraits of your other chiefs of staff and of Terry Lewin? You've given one of you've given them for Pym and Knott, two principal politicians,
yep.
and Frank Cooper, but. Could you do so for the other?
Yes, I could. Sergeant Taylor Lewin, Chief of Defence Staff, very able. We've been very close together on a number of occasions. Our minds were almost always, the exception to everything, but almost always in tune. We understood the way each other thought. And there I said, there was virtually total mutual respect. Dwin Bramall was the chief of the general staff. He was exactly my time. The three of us were the last, leaving aside Terry Lewin, although it applied to him as well, we were the last chiefs of staff with World War II experience. That doesn't count for all that much, but it counts for something, because war experience does count for quite a lot. And the fact that technology and many other things will have changed, hopefully before the next war, but there are lessons to be learned, just as there are lessons to be learned from World War I even, either in terms of what's good or in terms of what to avoid. And we're not very good at learning that sort of thing. We're bad on our history, usually. Dwin Bramall, very charming, very able, clever, very quiet, very approachable. And I never had any problems with him at all. And for example, when the Falklands War blew up, I found it necessary to, it was quite clear to me that, although arguably it wasn't my business, I'd already assumed that I would get a para-battalion, and when it became clear that we needed a second battalion, I went along to ask if that could also be another, and there was one, para-battalion. And he said, well, I'll see what I can do, but of course the other one is earmarked to NATO, and that may be difficult, etc., etc. And he tried, and we got it. I always find him very cooperative. We were great friends, and so forth. I have to say that my relationship with the Chief of the Air Staff was not quite so warm, shall I say. He had, on a number of occasions...
This is Michael Beetham.
He had, on a number of occasions, intervened over discussions in Chiefs of Staff meetings, and not just come very fairly close to, but had actually said, what you should be doing is... And on one occasion, I remember him saying, what you should be doing is to concentrate on minesweepers, and get rid of all these big ships, sort of thing, because of course he saw in the carriers, he saw a rival, and he was very narrow-minded about that sort of thing. He was capable of being, and at times was, pretty devious. He acted, and I hate to make this generalization, but there was something about so many, there were exceptions, of course, thank goodness, but so many senior Royal Air Force officers around at that time that they would go to any lengths to get what they wanted for their own service. And therefore, to that extent, they were so biased that they failed to exhibit, at any rate, the sort of level of statesmanship which you might reasonably have expected from any chief of staff. And he did not. There's my thumbnail sketch.
Thank you, Sir Henry. This is a good moment to change the tape.
Right.